The Acts of the Apostles, chapter 25, verse 1. Now when Festus was come into the province, after 3 days he ascended from Caesarea to Jerusalem. Then the high priest and the chief of the Jews informed him against Paul, and besought him, and desired favor against him, that he would send for him to Jerusalem, laying wait in the way to kill him. So the new governor is coming to his seat of power, and the chief of the Jews and the high priest again are trying to get Paul transported in the hopes that they might lay a ambush for him and thereby destroy him. They know that no good will ever come of any trial because Paul hasn't done anything that any secular government is going to see as criminal. And certainly they cannot provide evidence that he's done anything of that nature. So they are left with treachery, and that is what they intend to employ. Verse 4, But Festus answered that Paul should be kept at Caesarea, and that he himself would depart shortly thither. Let them therefore, said he, which among you are able, go down with me, and accuse this man, if there be any wickedness in him. And when he had tarried among them more than 10 days, he went down unto Caesarea. And the next day, sitting on the judgment seat, commanded Paul to be brought. And when he was come, the Jews which came down from Jerusalem stood round about, and laid many and grievous complaints against Paul, which they could not prove. While he answered for himself, neither against the law of the Jews, neither against the temple, nor yet against Caesar, have I offended anything at all. Paul's story is pretty simple. I haven't done anything to break any law, whether it be of the Jews, or of the regulations of the temple, or of the Roman law. The original reason was because some of the Jews from Asia Minor saw Paul in the temple, and they were very resentful of him because of the way he preached the gospel to the Gentiles. So it's basically a sort of a racist hatred of the Gentiles that has caused them to hate Paul. It's a case of betrayal. They feel betrayed. I mean, he was doing their work. I mean, Paul was basically a thug for the high priests and so on, bringing the Christians back to Jerusalem in chains. And when he turned into a Christian, of course, that's not going to set well with them. I guess I have a lot of thoughts about that. I think about the way when I turned away from my original teacher, Arnold Murray, the reaction of some people towards me was very interesting because some people seemed to think it couldn't be true, that I had been some sort of double agent from the beginning or something like that, or that my story was just made up or something. The idea that I was wholly given over to their way of thinking, and then that I changed my mind, people don't like to accept that. They don't want to accept that. Especially because sometimes when you're in a religious group, you know, they tend to think of the people who come into that group as being religiously enlightened. If you can accept the doctrines of Arnold Murray, you have eyes to see and ears to hear. You know, that's sort of the proof of it. If I can take you through the Bible and teach you about the doctrines of this particular sect or religious group, if you can grasp that and say that you see it, then I see you as one of my brethren. And that ability to see the doctrine is perceived by the members of the group as being the enlightenment of God. And the thought that you would turn from that would put a very dark shadow over you to some degree, like Satan is somehow influencing you. You are very devilish when you do this in the eyes of the people who you leave. And that explains a lot of the animosity towards Paul. And I feel like I kind of understand, and obviously it's a much more serious situation here, but I understand the feelings that people have towards those who depart from their group. It almost seems like they can't legitimately just change their mind somehow because God brought them into the group. you know, how could it be? He was with us. And so then some sort of evil motivation or scheme, they want to believe that there was something else at work, not just like you being convinced. And so I found that people didn't want to accept what happened to me. Many people. It just didn't fit into their worldview. It just is not possible. Now, I don't know if that applies to Paul and the Jews, but I've seen it among believers. And I'll tell you what, there's going to be a time in most believers' lives when maybe, there's a sort of a line in the sand drawn where over some critical doctrine or critical teaching, you find yourself parting from a group of believers who are, have deviated in some way from the truth. You know, if someone departs from your group, let's say you have a group and you think you're doing the right thing, the proper way to react to a member who has a disagreement and decides to separate themselves is to pray for them. You know, that God would open their eyes to the truth, or open your eyes to what they have to say. If you can't be persuaded by what they have to say, you could pray for them. But of course, the reaction of the Pharisees is absolutely unacceptable for Christians plotting the demise of a fellow man. And even to the lesser extent, a lot of times it's not so much murder, but we cannot abandon our Christian convictions when dealing with people we disagree with. You know what I'm saying? Sometimes when I have debates, I look at my older debates and I see I've got to do some notations on the internet about it, because I was more rough than I probably would be now. It's been, 8 years since I started engaging with people on my webpage. But even back then, I always felt like I was arguing with one hand tied behind my back, because there were things I wanted to say. There are ways in which I wanted to hurt them because they would hurt me. Say something hurtful, say something insulting. I wanted to insult back. And sometimes I did to some degree. And to what degree or the other that was wrong, I'm content to let the Lord judge and teach me the right way. But the point is, there is a sort of a burden on us as believers to maintain a higher standard for ourselves than the opponents will ever maintain on themselves. It's important because it's not always about being right. It's about the way we conduct ourselves in our lives. And in a debate, that is also important. Now, you're in a debate with some other believer. The utmost restraint should be exercised in the way you deal with that person, especially making personal remarks. Jesus said, you've heard that it was said, thou shalt not kill. You know, the Jews here are trying to kill Paul, and I'm trying to tie this into that. Thou shalt not kill. And whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. And I hope you see where I'm going with this. And he said, whosoever was angry with his brother, that guy's also in danger. And whosoever shall say, thou fool. So when we start engaging in a discussion, we're earnestly contending for the faith, you want to not sink to the level of name-calling. And if you find yourself getting angry, you need to take a step back and get a hold of yourself. Remember, this is the Lord's business we're engaged in. There's no reason for us to get all raged up about people disagreeing with us, even if we think we know what we say is the truth. The Lord is in control. If we really believe that, there's no reason to get angry. I know I've felt it rise up within me, especially when they come with their railing accusations, right? It's very tempting. But other than just righteousness, there are reasons why we should exercise self-control in those situations. Of course, for the very sake of self-control, it should always be exercised because it is a righteous thing. But also, believe me, when other people listen to a debate, the person who is calling names and being unreasonable is shutting off the ears of people who are on the fence. You know, you won't win any points with his buddies. If you maybe somehow score a rhetorical victory by getting really insulting and kind of putting them down and, ooh, I got him with a zinger, you may make them ooh and ah with, the wittiness of your verbal acrobatics in putting that person down, but you're not going to convince them that way either. And the people on the fence are going to look and they're going to say, among these two, I don't want to listen to either of them. They both seem like very unreasonable people who are just railing one at the other. You know, Paul talked about people we shouldn't eat with for certain sins, unrepented of. And I take it to be unrepented of. You know, fornicators, drunkards, railers. A railer is a person who is verbally abusive. And so we definitely want to try to control ourselves. Obviously, sometimes, you know, I see examples in the scriptures, you scribes, you Pharisees, you hypocrites. But because the Lord did it, does not give us a license to just do it all the time. We are to, in meekness, instruct those that oppose themselves. In patience. You know, if someone's behaving hypocritically, then it may be reasonable to point out the hypocrisy. But because of the sort of loadedness of that term, because the Lord used it, it's not always wise to just trot that out every time. It's one thing to say, you're a hypocrite, but it's another thing to say, you know, have you analyzed how what you're saying is kind of hypocritical? That's very diplomatic, and maybe some people would be offended and say, no, you should speak bluntly. I think it is pretty blunt. It's just a more diplomatic way of saying it, because I'm not the Lord. The Lord had absolute certainty of the rightness of his cause. And until I obtain that absolute certainty, I'm going to behave cautiously. Because I'm not operating with a divine revelation. I'm not all-knowing. And the Lord instructed his disciples to shake the dust off their feet of those who wouldn't receive them. But I have not received that commandment from the Lord. That's another thing people do. I shake the dust off my feet at you. It's an idiom. It doesn't necessarily mean, you know, utter this phrase. You know, it should not be used as a 2x4 with which to beat one another, especially other believers who just happen to have a disagreement with you. It's not someone who's rejecting the gospel of Jesus Christ. It's someone who isn't persuaded by you or me. And if they aren't persuaded by us, maybe it's because we're not persuasive enough. Or maybe the Lord has closed their eyes. And maybe yet he will open them. But I would be very careful in how we deal with those who profess the name of Jesus Christ, right? I try to do that myself, and some people may disagree. Others may think I'm too light. I don't know. I try for my own conscience sake to exercise caution and at the same time speak plainly. And that's all tying back to this in Acts. Basically, when someone departs from us, how should we react? When someone disagrees with us, how should we react? The high priest and the leaders of the Jews reacted with murder. But according to the Lord Jesus Christ, there's a higher standard. Angry with your brother. Calling him names. I remember my first teacher, Arnold Murray, from years back. When he came to the part about, you know, whoever shall say thou fool, it's interesting the way he would equivocate about it and say, well, that word fool is moros, and it means someone absolutely void of spiritual understanding. And so he takes Jesus' words in a very literal sense, very letter of the law. Well, you don't call someone moros, but you can call him a fool, yeah. You can call him a jerk. You can call him an idiot, or how about stupid, or any number of other insults, just so long as you don't call him a moron. Is that what Jesus was talking about? There's one word you shall never call a brother. See, what they don't understand is that the words of Jesus should not be taken there legalistically. What it means is words matter. Your heart matters just as much as your deeds matter. You know, the way we feel about our brethren is as important as whether or not we're actually trying to do them in. And how we talk to our brother is also important. I see so many Christians in online debates just really ripping into each other, and in such a way that it's absolutely unacceptable. And if they really understood the spirit of what Jesus said, they would understand that they are in danger of the fire of the veil of Hinnom. That is not acceptable behavior in the sight of God. It's one thing, I've made mistakes, and I have been sorry and tried to change, right, in the way I talk to people. I'm very slow to remove any work I've done because I don't want to start erasing my history. But I would rather put in notations and little comments to sort of, so when future people look at those, they will see how my feelings about it have changed, or how I would have done things slightly differently. And I want to do that because I want to give people examples of things they should and shouldn't do. How do we deal with a brother who goes astray? Oh, if I had been in the days of my fathers, I would not have done as they did. That's what the Jews said about the prophets who were put to death. If we had been in the days of our father, we would not have participated with them in the blood of the prophets. It's so easy with retrospect to say, we aren't like the Pharisees. We wouldn't do what they do. Don't justify yourself, Christian, when you do the same things. You would never participate in seeking to put Paul to death. But when you go online, it's so much easier through the anonymity to become very crude and cruel towards other human beings. You will say things that you would never say in person. People say the worst sort of cruel things that they would just not dream of. But in a sense, it's the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. And it is what's in their heart. Now, most of the time, their socialization prevents them from walking up to someone and spitting in their face. But they will do the equivalent of that through email and through discussion boards, and behave in a very unacceptable way. So we need to learn to behave acceptably, so that we will not only convince the gainsayers, but also that they who observe us would see the righteousness of our cause and the righteousness of our behavior. And we will labor to obtain this like we do every other virtue that is in Christ, through faith that he is going to deliver us to do it right, and through perseverance in that, that we might obtain it. So I have great confidence that we can do this and much more. Verse 9, but Festus, willing, or purposing, to do the Jews a pleasure, answered Paul and said, wilt thou go up to Jerusalem, and there be judged of these things before me? Are you willing to go? He would like to do the Jews a favor, so he says, he poses the question to Paul. Verse 10, then said Paul, I stand at Caesar's judgment seat, where I ought to be judged. To the Jews have I done no wrong, as thou very well knowest. For if I be an offender, or have committed anything worthy of death, I refuse not to die. But if there be none of these things whereof they accuse me, no man may deliver me unto them. I appeal unto Caesar. So Paul pulls the trump card of his right as a Roman citizen to appeal to Caesar. He doesn't want to be judged by them. He knows they just want to do him in. He's not willing to submit himself to their judgment. Why should he? He hasn't done anything to offend them. If he had, he would gladly submit himself, because he is a law-abiding Jew and a Christian as well, seeking to do all things correct and all things right according to the teachings of Christ and according to what he has learned in his upbringing. Verse 12, then Festus, when he had conferred with the council, answered, hast thou appealed unto Caesar? Unto Caesar shalt thou go. I don't wonder if he isn't a little bit miffed at Paul's reaction. He wanted to do the Jews a favor. Obviously, Paul can do him no favor, but rather only cause annoyance. As long as Paul remains in his custody, the Jews are not going to stop bothering him. Can't let Paul go because the Jews will kill him. And Paul doesn't want to be judged by them. He can't allow just the Jews to murder a Roman citizen. It would not be acceptable. He could be in trouble. Verse 13, and after certain days, King Agrippa and Bernice came to Caesarea to salute Festus. This King Agrippa would be the Agrippa II, the son of the Herod from chapter 12, verse 14. And when they had been there many days, Festus declared Paul's cause unto the king, saying, there is a certain man left in bonds by Felix, about whom, when I was at Jerusalem, the chief priests and the elders of the Jews informed me, desiring to have judgment against him. To whom I answered, it is not the manner of the Romans to deliver any man to die, before that he which is accused have the accusers face to face, and have license to answer for himself concerning the crime laid against him. Simple assertion of the Roman legal system. We don't just put people to death. We allow them to see their accusers. I mean, Paul's a Roman citizen, so he is afforded all the rights of citizenship. He has a right to a fair trial. And of course, they haven't been able to provide any good evidence against him, except just accusations. Verse 17. Therefore, when they were come thither, without any delay on the morrow, I sat on the judgment seat, and commanded the man to be brought forth, against whom, when the accusers stood up, they brought none accusation of such things as I supposed, but had certain questions against him of their own superstition, and of one Jesus, which was dead, whom Paul affirmed to be alive. And because I doubted of such manner of questions, I asked him whether he would go to Jerusalem, and there be judged of these matters. But when Paul had appealed to be reserved to the hearing of Augustus, I commanded him to be kept till I might send him to Caesar. The reference to Augustus. Now, Augustus was Octavius Caesar in the days when Jesus was born. And Jesus was crucified in the reign of Tiberius. Augustus is long gone. This isn't some sort of mistake, but in the Greek it is Sebastos, which means venerable. In fact, that's what the meaning of Augustus is in Latin. And this is the Greek equivalent. Augustus was a title Octavian applied to himself. Augustus Caesar, venerable Caesar. Just as all the Caesars afterwards were called Caesar, even though the original was Julius Caesar, and many of these guys were not relations of his, though Augustus was adopted and Tiberius was adopted into the family, and that's how for a while the Romans, their emperors were adopted sons, and that system worked well for them for a while. So it's one of the succeeding emperors, you know, they're referring to him by the same title, the August One, the Venerable Caesar. Well, you know, they're not referring to him by name, in other words. So this Augustus is not a first name. It's not referring to Augustus Caesar, the son of Julius Octavian. So he plans to send him to Augustus. The question is all about the Jews' religion. And, of course, he doesn't really know on what basis the Roman law could condemn a man for not adhering to the Jews' religion. There's no basis. And be like someone, going to court in America over a dispute about the Trinity. They would have no standing on which to judge that case. Even if one side could be proved over the other, it would just be absolutely out of their jurisdiction. How does one judge such a thing? Verse 22, then Agrippa said unto Festus, I would also hear the man myself. Tomorrow, said he, thou shalt hear him. And on the morrow, when Agrippa was come, and Bernice, with great pomp, and was entered into the place of hearing, but the chief captains and principal men of the city, at Festus' commandment Paul was brought forth. And Festus said, King Agrippa, and all men which are here present with us, ye see this man, about whom all the multitude of the Jews have dealt with me, both at Jerusalem and also here, crying that he ought not to live any longer. You know, it's remarkable when so many people want someone dead for whatever reason. It fascinates Especially, you know, it probably seems somewhat mystifying to secular-minded people, people who are not particularly religious. When he says their superstition, it's religion, you know, it means their beliefs, their ideas of what, you know, gods there are, unless we don't really like to deal with that as secular people. You know, that's his perspective, and it's remarkable. You know, the king, Agrippa, he follows the Jews' religion, but there are nominal people in the religion, especially when it's a sort of a state religion like the Jews' religion. All the Jews were of that religion, and it would make sense for the king of the Jews, quote-unquote, Agrippa, even though he was Edomian of the Edomites, it would make sense for him to adopt that religion so as not to be offensive. You know, to have a pagan king would probably annoy the Jews exceedingly. But if he would at least honor the high priest and honor the God as they would expect him to, they will put up with him, even if he is not really their right king. Verse 25. But when I found that he had committed nothing worthy of death, and that he himself hath appealed to Augustus, I have determined to send him, of whom I have no certain thing to write unto my lord. Wherefore I have brought him forth before you, and especially before thee, O King Agrippa, that after examination had, I might have somewhat to write. Saying I am kind of at a loss for what to write about him. I've got to send some sort of word to Caesar so he would know what to do with him. I mean, how many of the Jews are going to follow Paul to Rome? Doubtless there will be present at Rome those who will be willing to do the will of the priests at Jerusalem and to accuse Paul. But of course, Caesar will want something from the governor. Verse 27, for it seemeth to me unreasonable to send a prisoner and not withal to signify the crimes laid against him. Yeah, that would be unreasonable. It would not seem proper. Unreasonable in the Greek is alogos. Logos is the word from which we get logic. And the a prefix means no, like not logical. Logos is the word translated word. You know, the idea in the beginning of the book of John. In the beginning was the word, the logos. It means more than just like word or spoken word. But we won't go into that right now. We're going to close up this study, and I'm going to release the chapter 26 at the same time, so we'll be able to pick it up right away.